We're recording everything now, and I'm going to reset my screen here. Oops, that's not what I meant to do. Close enough. All right, so where things stand. Is everybody with me first off? Let me make sure that everybody's back online, paying attention and with me. How about I get some thumbs up and see who's here? And all right, cool. You guys are mostly paying attention. All right, this is what everybody's paying attention. Nice. All right, that's what I like to see. So today we're doing distillation lab, and what I've kind of decided to do a little bit is, rather than doing the labs the way that we would have done them by following the actual lab in Pavia, what I'm following more now is the appendix section in Pavia. Within the appendix section, there are individual skill sets, and they have a lot more information within the appendix section on each of these topics than they do within the actual experiment itself. And there are questions, which I did not realize ever, because I read the appendix section, I look at it for content, but I've never actually gone to the end of the appendix section and looked. And they have, at the end of those sections, questions, which are really good questions, which are more general theory type questions. And I think that those are the questions that I'm going to rely on a little bit more. And so I'll put those together and put together a subset and email those out for each of the labs. We're going to spend, I think, 2 days on distillation. So what I'm going to do is go through in this first day and give you all the theory and background. And yeah, this is a lab that most people really wanted to do. The distillation lab is a cool one because you get to set up a large-scale glassware for the first time. And we do two different distillations. We do it in teams, is the way that we had conducted it. The experiment was to give you a mixture, a binary mixture, two compounds. The compounds options were hexane, cyclohexane, heptane, toluene, and ethylbenzene. You got a pair of compounds, and your job was to distill the compounds using a fractional distillation, a large distillation, and a simple distillation, and then to compare the results using gas chromatography to measure how good a separation you got from the two different types of distillations. That was the whole experiment. And it was a 3-day experiment. You did 2 days of distillation because it took you a day for the fractional and a day for the simple. And then we had a whole day on chromatography. And sometimes it went into a 4-day lab because the gas chromatography took actually 2 days in order to get everybody through. And I trained you guys how to use the GCs in that regard. But we'll turn it into a 2-day lab. 1 day where I talk about the distillation itself. 2nd day, a little bit more about different types of distillation and on the chromatography and how to use the gas chromatogram. So that's kind of where we're at. And if there are no further questions, I'll just kind of jump into distillation and show you guys what we want to do. Okay? And I think it's about an hour and a half lecture from here. I think it's what I did this morning. So to start off with a little bit of history on distillation, what I want to grab, actually it's going to be, yeah, no, I got to grab it from where I originally took it. Let's copy this piece. And take it back into where we're working. Okay, so these are a set of distillation apparatuses. And I like to show sort of the evolution of the glassware and where it comes from. Distillation is a very old technique. Distillation started with the alchemical, with alchemists in the early 1600s. And what they were finding was that they could purify substances, change substances, split them into constituents through distillation. And the way that they did that was with very simple glassware. They used two different types. One was called a retort. So we've got the retort type glassware. This was a two-piece type of glassware. And the still pot is how we refer to the piece of the glassware where you're heating. We had a long arm that acted as a condenser. And then we have a receiving flask. The other piece of glassware that was used frequently was called a retort. The alembic. The alembic was a three-piece glassware. So the still pot was down here, and it was a little bit easier to fill because of the shape of it. It's shaped almost like a Erlenmeyer flask. And then the condenser was a secondary piece that fit on top. And then you had the receiving flask. And out of those two pieces of glassware, the retort is what became the model for the sort of modern day type of distillation apparatus that we use. And the alembic also morphed into a more modern state type of distillation apparatus, but they're both very different in the way that they're set up and they do different jobs. So originally, when we went from the retort in the late 1800s, what they did is they came up with this sort of model distillation where they broke it into three pieces of glassware. You have the distilling flask, you have the condenser, and you have the receiving flask, but these were all held together with corks. And so they had pieces of glassware that were stuck together with corks, and the whole thing was basically managed through a series of corks holding all the different pieces of the glassware in place that they needed to be. That changed to standard ground glass joints. So they say tapered joints here, but these are ground glass joints. And the ground glass joints hold together much more solidly, and they can actually be clamped together in place and held in place. And the condenser changed from what was an air condenser to a water jacketed condenser. And in these water jacketed condensers, water goes in. So this is H2O in and H2O out. And then that type of glassware changed to this small research type of glassware. And this is what we actually have, a set of these at Cabrillo. And we did the experiment with the set of these small pieces of glassware. And these are exactly the same. They have a thermometer that goes in them. They have ground glass joints, but this is all one molded piece of glassware. And it has a condenser where water goes in and water comes out. And the port that is on the side over here, this guy, this is called a vacuum adapter. The vacuum adapter is used for actually reducing the pressure within the distillation for doing vacuum distillations. This guy also has a vacuum adapter, but it has a more important function. The more important function is that it keeps the system open to the atmosphere when it's unplugged. And you never want to plug that vacuum adapter, because if you do, the system becomes a bomb. If you look through this, at each point in the retort, there's an opening that is here, and so that gas can come out to equilibrate. In the system here, it's open, such that gas can come out and equilibrate with the atmospheric pressure. The vacuum adapter serves that purpose in the two more modern pieces of distilling glassware. And without that open port, when you heat a system, the pressure that develops within the system develops to such a degree that the glassware would explode. It would become a bomb if we didn't actually have that opening in the glassware, either the vacuum adapter or the opening in the older systems. The the alembic type, made of three pieces of glassware, morphed into an interesting sort of configuration. In the 1950s, they turned it into a more vertical type. So we have the condenser that is in this vertical type. And the condenser has water that essentially goes in and out of this. The water in these, though, I'm trying to figure out. I don't quite understand the drawing that they've got here. Usually, the condenser is two pieces of glassware where water goes clearly in and clearly out and connects. And I don't see where they're connecting their condenser. So I think the drawing on the condenser is a little bit messed up. But the still pot, this down here is the still pot. And the receiving flask is here. And it's in a vertical orientation. And this allows us to be able to take a round bottom or some other appropriate container and to drain out the contents of whatever is inside that receiving flask and to be able to pull it out that way through the ground glass joint. These types of distillation apparatuses were used. My notability just crashed. Let me come back. Okay. These types of distilling apparatuses are still used a lot today, but they are used for, let's see, there's a couple of questions from Colin. Is the H2O in and out for coolant? Yes, it is. It is for cold water to recondense the gaseous vapors into a liquid state and trap them. So we use cold water, usually just out of the tap, but sometimes we will set up a 5-gallon bucket with a pump in it and ice and circulate cold water through it, much the same way we do with the condensers on the rotovaps. So you guys saw the rotovaps, you saw how the rotovaps work, and we use that recirculating water with ice water. You can do the same thing with these guys, although typically we just use cold water is enough. And Finn, boiling out the water? No. What happens is in the still pot here, we heat this with some sort of heating apparatus, not generally a flame. We don't use the open flames, but I usually use that to indicate that we're using some sort of heater. We put a heating mantle on this that gets plugged into the wall and we heat it up. The liquid inside it boils. And as the liquid boils, what happens is the gas goes up and hits the condenser. As the gas hits the condenser, let me change colors here actually and reverse that. Because conceptually, we can use red for hot vapors. The hot vapors go up and hit the coil. When the hot vapors hit the coil, they condense back in, down into a liquid. And as they condense into a liquid, the liquid rolls on the edges and gets trapped down in that reservoir. And that's how the whole system works. So it condenses the vapors back down into a liquid, trapping the liquid into a separate container. And these types of apparatuses are used for drying solvents on demand. So when I want a solvent in lab and I want that solvent to be perfectly dry without any water in it, I would have a drying agent that would fit in the pot down here. So we put a drying agent, some sort of chemical drying agent in there, and then I crank it up and do the distillation, and what comes out of it is dry solvent. And so these are solvent stills. And in labs where they do certain types of air-sensitive chemistry that requires very dry solvents, they will have two or three of these stills set up in the lab for different solvents, and they will on demand crank up that still before they do a reaction, getting their dry solvent out, and then they will go through and do their experiment with that dry solvent. So that is different from these types of apparatuses, which are truly used for distillations for separating out different compounds. And then on a microscale kit, this is the way we do a distillation on microscale. It uses the Hickman still. So the Hickman still, or the Hickman head, is this piece of glassware here. And you can see its sort of receiving flask shape that came from that macro scale apparatus. And the way that this one works is much the same way. We take and we put a heating bath onto this, and we plug this thing into a wall and heat it up. The hot vapors will travel from the boiling material up. They will hit the condenser where there is cold water circulating. So cold water goes in, H2O in, and H2O out, always working against gravity for the water. That water is a cold water that fits out here. That's too big. Let's try that one more time. Shrink that down. So that water fits in the outer chamber and fills that outer chamber and is isolated from the inner chamber. In the inner chamber, the liquid then hits that wall and condenses on the wall. And as it condenses, it falls back down as a liquid and gets trapped in that Hickman still. And most Hickman stills then also have a port on the side of them. This port has a cap that fits over it. And when we want, we go into that with a pipette and we pull out the materials that we want to pull out using a pipette going in through the side port in the Hickman still. And if it doesn't have a side port on it, like some of yours in class don't have side ports, you have to remove the water jacketed condenser at the end of the experiment and then put the pipette down the top of the Hickman still in order to pull out the contents that have been trapped in the reservoir there in the side. So that's a little bit about the glassware and how the glassware is evolved and shaped, and a little bit about the distillation apparatus. What we need to do is talk about how distillation works, why it works, and why this is a great technique. So distillation is used for the purification of multiple components. Let's see, Colin. So the Hickman apparatus is good for small quantities. The Hickman apparatus is only good for small quantities. Quantity-wise, if we're looking at quantity-wise, in the large-scale distillations that are up in this range, you can do anywhere from 25 mils on up to a liter or more. They can be very large volumes that you do in distillations there. In the micro-scale range, we're doing this sort of in the 5 milliliter on up to maybe 25 or 50 milliliters. I'd say 25 is probably about as big as I would go in that type of flask. When you're into the micro scale, this size, you're doing like half a milliliter on up to maybe 5 milliliters, because that's what you can hold in a 5 mil conical vial. And the still pots are usually pretty large. The still pots are usually on the range of like 100 milliliters on up to a liter or two in terms of what the still pots are. So depending upon what it is you're trying to separate, or if you're doing just a solvent, you choose the type of distilling apparatus based on what it is you're distilling. And also the golden rule of thumb, which is that whenever you have a still pot, that we never want to fill the pot more than halfway full. Especially when you're going to be boiling something. What you need is you need this empty headroom. For gases and boiling safety. If you don't have that space that's up above it that's empty, then when the system goes to boil, it will boil up into the condenser. And that means that liquid starts to expand up into the ground glass joints and things can leak. It also means that if there is any sort of vigorous bumping, there is no place for the gas to expand into. And that can cause the apparatus to break and shatter. And when you're heating things and solvent breaks like that, you can get large scale fires. So for safety reasons, let's say that we're working with 25 milliliters of solvent, then that would indicate that I would need at least a 50 milliliter flask so that I don't fill it more than halfway full when I go through and do my distillation. So the size of my distillation is dependent upon how much it is that I'm trying to separate. And I choose my glassware appropriately so that I never fill my glassware more than 50% full. Okay. So those are good questions. Okay. So distillation is a purification technique, is the way that I think about it. Purification of liquids. So what we had, Finn, wouldn't organic solvents explode if they're heated with no carbon rocks? How do you get around that? What we do is in every distillation, we put a spin vane. The spin vane adds agitation and allows for boiling to happen in much the same way that putting boiling stones in would, so that we don't get a superheated solution and that we don't get bumping or explosive boiling. So that's how we get around that. We tend not to use, this is much more efficient. It's more efficient than using boiling stones, is to put a spin vane in it. So there are different shapes and sizes of spin vanes, and we just choose a spin vane appropriate to the size of the flask or container that we're working with. And those are Teflon coated magnets. Basically what it is it's just a little bar magnet that's in there, and then it's got a Teflon coating over the magnet that makes it into a little spin vane. And sometimes they are football shaped, sometimes they are just rod shaped. They can be all different shapes depending and sizes depending on what it is you're trying to do. So that's how we get around that part. Okay, so distillation is a purification of liquids, and a number of different types of techniques that we have looked at so far. So we looked at recrystallization. Recrystallization was purification of solids. And it worked in a range where we needed to be sort of in the, 75% to 90% range starting purity. We also did another extraction technique. This was purification of solids. Usually solutes. And this one depended upon solubility and structure. So this depended on functional group. So that you could do acid base extraction. You could also pull out a neutral compound. From acid or base impurity. There was no, Finn, wouldn't organic solvents explode if they're, how do you do that on a micro scale? Do spin vanes fit in the conical vials? Yeah, we have a small spin vane that fits in a conical vial. So actually, that's an image there of the spin vane is right there. It's a triangularly shaped spin vane. And it's got sort of, if you do it on its side, it's got a bar magnet that fits out both sides of it. That's not a very good drawing. It's got basically a bar magnet that fits through the triangular spin vane. So that's on edge. This is on flat. And it's just a bar magnet that is triangularly shaped piece of plastic that fits down into the conical nature of the conical vial. So that's the way that that's done. Okay, so extractions did not have a range of starting purity. They could be any starting purity. In terms of going through and doing extractions. Distillations is really the purifications of liquids, and these can be any purity as well. And we need to talk about sort of how this works and why this works. So if we want to talk about how it works and why it works, let's start off with talking about boiling points and looking at how the boiling point of a liquid works. So what is the boiling point of a liquid? When does a liquid boil? What defines what a boiling point is? For instance, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, let's say that we've got two people. We've got a little guy down here who's at ocean level. And he's trying to make some pasta on a little campfire. So he's got his campfire going and he's trying to boil his water on this little campfire. And his water, when it boils, boils at 100 degrees C. And then you got another little guy up here, up in the mountains. And he's trying to do the same thing. He's trying to make pasta on his campfire. And the problem is that his water boils at 96 degrees C. So why are the two pieces of water or the two pots of water boiling at different temperatures? Yeah, Matt, it boils when it becomes vapor, but pressure, yeah. So how does pressure relate to the boiling point? What, that's the difference. The difference is the atmospheric pressure. So we have pressure of the atmosphere, which is down at sea level, and the pressure of the atmosphere, which is up in the mountains. And the pressure that is down at sea level is much greater than the pressure that's up in the mountains. So it is the atmospheric pressure. But how is boiling point relating to atmospheric pressure? Has anybody got a clue? Want to chime in? Want to hit the space bar and voice an opinion?
I think it's because there's less water at a higher altitude, so it causes it to boil faster because it needs to release.
It's not quite less water. Let me draw another image. And so we'll take this image for now.
I can explain it with the PV NRT equation.
Tell me.
It's PV equals NRT, so you need the same amount of, like, the ratios need to equal out in some way. So they're directly related or directly proportional, right?
Let me try this. It's not exactly what I'm looking for. Let's look at a container. PV equals NRT is going to come into it later on, yes. And PV equals NRT is part of this answer, but in a different way. It comes from the Dalton's law of partial pressures. But let's deal with it this way. Let's take a beaker of water, or any liquid, really. And with this beaker, what we have is we have the pressure of the atmosphere, which is pushing down on the liquid, right? And inside this liquid, there is, if we just say that this is water, inside this liquid, the liquid is evaporating, and what is coming out of this liquid is the pressure of the vapor. And so that's what we call the vapor pressure. And that is happening through evaporation. And when those two pressures are equal, well, there's three different situations that we can have. Let's look at a gas bubble. So we'll draw a generic gas bubble here. in the generic gas bubble, we have the pressure of the vapor that is inside of this gas bubble, and it's pushing out such that the bubbles that we see are not filled with air, but they're filled with gaseous liquid of whatever that liquid was. And what's pushing on this bubble is the pressure of the atmosphere. And the pressure of the atmosphere is pushing in on all directions on this bubble. And there's three different situations that we can think of. We can think about the pressure of the atmosphere being greater than the pressure of the vapor. We could think about the pressure of the atmosphere being equal to the pressure of the vapor. Or we could think about the pressure of the atmosphere being less than the pressure of the vapor. If the pressure of the atmosphere is greater than the pressure of the vapor, the bubble will collapse. We get no bubble. But we do get evaporation. So gaseous liquid, or the gaseous material, will form from the liquid, go into the vapor state, and will exert a vapor pressure of its own. When the pressure of the atmosphere equals the pressure of the vapor, then we get boiling. And this is what we call the boiling point. The boiling point is the temperature required to raise the vapor pressure to be equal to the atmospheric pressure. That's what the boiling point actually is. And the bubble can exist when the two pressures are equal. And so the gaseous bubbles will form within the liquid and, based on their lower density, will rise and explode out of the solution. And that's what we see as boiling. So boiling, the boiling point is the temperature at which the vapor pressure of the vapor, is equal to the atmospheric pressure. Let me see if I can stop my tablet sharing for a second. And I want to try and share something else with you. I tried to do this morning and it didn't work for me, but let me see if I can do it now. So I want to go in and that is not what I want. I want Zoom. I want to stop the screen share. Okay, and then I want to screen share from my desktop. Okay, and now screen sharing from my desktop, what I want to do is to find an animation. Cabrillo College, extracurricular, ammonia. And I'm going to zoom through this for a second. Okay, let me ask before I start this, can you guys see the picture of the desiccator and the vacuum pump so that's what's being screen shared? Are we all good? I can't see your screen now where I can see thumbs up, but I think I can see it in the participant window. If you give me a thumbs up or a check mark, Colin gave me a check mark. You can see, okay, cool. So you guys can see it. All right, what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna play this animation. I don't know if you're gonna be able to hear it. But what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna zoom through this a little bit and just, what I have inside the desiccator is, let me just stop it here. This is a thermometer that's in there. And the thermometer inside, and then this piece right here, which you can't see real well, is a beaker full of water that the thermometer is sitting in the beaker of water. And it gets a little bit clearer as the video goes on. So what I do is I show the inside where you can see the beaker and the thermometer going down into it. You can see the temperature here, 75 degrees Fahrenheit. That's the outside temperature. The inside of that is, well, maybe it is 75. I'm gonna put the lid on the desiccator and then I'm gonna attach the vacuum to the desiccator and then I'm gonna zoom in on it and I'm gonna turn on the vacuum pump And so there's my hand turning on the vacuum pump. And as I turn on the vacuum pump, it's going to remove all of the air that's inside this glass desiccator. So that water sitting in the desiccator is 75 degrees Fahrenheit. Water boils at 212 degrees Fahrenheit. So I'm gonna play this real quick. I don't know if you can hear it, but the vacuum pump's on. I think it's just playing through my headphones so I can hear my own voice talking, which is annoying, but let me get this out of the way. So the vacuum pump is running, and what we're going to see is on the thermometer itself, oh, did you see that bubble that just went? Here's more bubbles that are starting to happen. Look at the temperature. The water has not changed, but the water is boiling, and I'm not heating it. In fact, look at the temperature. Temperature's going down. It went down to 73. Now 71. And the temperature keeps going down. It's going to drop 69. And the water's boiling. Right? So now I'm going to shut off the pump. And when I shut off the pump, the water immediately stops boiling. And then I'm going to let the air back in. So when I let the air back in, the temperature of the water is colder than it was. The water actually boiled, and the water got colder as it boiled. So I can stick my hand in there, and that water is not, yeah, so water boils in outer space because there's no pressure in outer space. And because the vacuum of outer space has no atmospheric pressure, the water instantly boils. That's exactly what happens to you. So if you like get thrown out into outer space, your blood literally boils because there's no pressure pushing on you anymore. And so the vapor pressure from your blood actually literally boils within your body, within the veins. That's kind of freaky. All right, that was not a great note to end on. Yeah, bummer. Finn, don't ask questions like that anymore. Okay, so that's my little demonstration, that we can make water boil at any temperature, essentially, that we want by increasing or decreasing the pressure on the water. And that is not just for water. That is true of all liquids, that we can change the boiling point by changing the pressure because they are dependent upon one another. The higher the pressure, the higher the boiling point. The lower the pressure, the lower the boiling point, because a liquid boils when its vapor pressure equals atmospheric pressure. So that's my cool demonstration. I wish I could have shown that to them this morning. I couldn't quite get that to work this morning. But I'm going to ditch back into my tablet. So I'm going to stop screen sharing here if I can figure out how. I'm learning all my tools here. And I'm going to go back to screen sharing on my iPad. And we will go back to the drawing. Okay, so we should be good now. We should be back on the iPad. And I can see everybody's comments again, and I can see thumbs up and things. So then how does water boil under the ocean? That's an odd question in that I don't know that I understand it. Water can boil at any pressure, it just takes more heat. So that if we wanted to, for instance, boil water near a volcanic vent, then the water is superheated. The water is not boiling at 212, the water is boiling at 300, 400, 500. The water has to get hotter in order to boil until such time that the vapor pressure that is created equals the resonant pressure at that level under the sea. So yes, the water just has to get superheated near a volcanic vent. And that means that water is way hotter than boiling water. It is sometimes thousands of degrees in terms of how hot that water is. Yeah, real darn hot. Okay, so the boiling point, we know what the boiling point is now. So here's our boiling point. And if the pressure of the atmosphere becomes less than the pressure of the vapor, this is where we get bumping. That is our explosive boiling. That's what we try to avoid. So we generally don't want that to happen. But so that's a little bit about boiling. So once we understand boiling, now we can look at a two-component mixture. And so what happens with boiling is we can look at a couple of different graphs. We can look at types of temperature versus time behavior. Temp versus time behavior of systems while boiling. So number one, let's do a single component. Basically, this is a pure material. Let's call that pure material A. So what we're going to do is we're going to take and make a graph here of this is time and temp. And basically what we see is that as we increase the temperature, a system will come up into boiling and then it will stay at its boiling point and it will not change temperature while it's boiling. So this is boiling and this is pure A. And essentially that correlates to a phase diagram. So if you think about going back to a phase diagram that you may have studied in Chem 1A, Chem 1B, the phase diagram has the different phases in it. And so what you're looking at is you're looking at solid, you're looking at melting, you're looking at liquid and boiling. And then you're looking at gas. And then I don't really have a phase transition for gas. I kind of threw that in there, but that doesn't need to be there. And so this is temp and this is energy as we put energy into the system. And so boiling requires energy be input. So the energy of that system that we're putting in is being used to boil the material, but there's no change in temp while the material boils. And that's what we see here is that there's no change in temp while that material is boiling. And that, and so that's for a pure substance. Now what happens with a mixture? Let's look at a mixture. Okay, so number two, let's do a two component mixture. So we have a two component mixture of A and B with close boiling points. So the boiling points of A and B are very similar. In this case, what winds up happening is the two component mixture heats up, starts to boil, and then looks kind of mushy like this. So this is time, this is temp, and this is A plus B mixture. We're getting close to just B and close to just A, but a lot of it is a mixture of material that is coming out and a smoother curve of temperature. And it is very hard to separate. What this is indicating is that it is hard to separate two compounds with similar boiling points. If we take a third case, where we look at a two-component mixture it's hard to not want to go back and fix. There we go. This is A, and let's call it C to give it a different material, and these two have very different boiling points. Then what we wind up seeing is we see an increase to compound A and then an increase to compound B. So this is pure A, pure C, and a fairly sharp heating curve in terms of transition from A to C. And this gives good separation. Of A and C, because I can take and I can isolate each one of these so that I can capture this piece and capture this piece and put them into different containers and isolate them almost in the same way that we talked about isolating them in column chromatography, or it's just that I have to have different receiving fractions on my distillation, and we'll talk about how that works. So the question is, what is it about the boiling points, and how are the boiling points used to separate out these compounds? It's not just a matter of the fact that the material boils at different points. It has to do with the constituency of the vapor versus, or the composition of the vapor versus the composition of the liquid. And so what we need to do is a discussion here about two-component mixtures and the vapor composition versus the liquid composition. So that's our next topic. So we have vapor composition. As compared to liquid composition. In a two-component mixture. And this can be extended to multi-component. Which means that I can take and do distillations on mixtures that have four things in them, five things in them, six things in them, and the analogy expands to however many things are in the mixture. So I can do distillations of large components rather than just binary things. So distillation is more versatile than what we are making it sound when we deal with just two component mixtures. So let's do this two component mixture though and look at what happens here. Okay, so usually what I do is take and do this from, I'm gonna stay away from Raoult's Law. Usually what I do is I bring Raoult's Law into it, or I tried to do that this morning and it didn't make as much sense as I wanted it to make, but let's try and do it without Raoult's Law and then maybe I'll move into that. So let's take a beaker and look at a two-component mixture where the boiling points are the same. So we've got case one, boiling points of A and B, same. So I have the solution, and it has a two-component mixture in it. And in this two-component mixture, we have these two components, and they both have vapor pressures. So the vapor pressures, because the boiling points are the same, the vapor pressures are the same. And therefore, vapor pressure and when we're talking about vapor pressure, PV equals NRT. This is the basis for Raoult's Law. Raoult's Law is basically looking at the fact that when you have the pressure and the number of moles, and in PV equals NRT, the relationship here says that the pressure is proportional to to the number of moles. And this is directly proportional. It's not an equality. In order to get inequality, we need to get a proportionality constant in there, and we can talk about what that proportionality constant is, and that proportionality constant is different for each material. But the pressure of the vapor, because that's what we're looking at, is proportional, directly proportional to the number of moles. If we wanted to do that in terms of an actual equality, we would say that the pressure of the vapor is equal to the vapor pressure of the pure material times the mole fraction of the material. So we could say the pressure of the vapor of constituent A is equal to these three things. So this is the vapor pressure. This is the pure vapor pressure. This is vapor pressure in mixture. And this guy is the mole fraction. The mole fraction, Na, is equal to the moles of A divided by the moles of A plus the moles of B. And so it's related to the mole fraction, not actually related to directly to the moles, but it's proportional to the number of moles. So if we use all of that information, what that says is that when I look up in here at the gas, and these are the gaseous components, that the gaseous components are going to be reflective of what's in solution because their boiling points are the same. So what I'm seeing is that I'm getting about the same number of moles of gas of each constituent because their boiling points happen to be the same, and therefore their vapor pressures are the same. So there's no real difference there. Okay, let's take case two, where A and B have different boiling points, and we'll see how this relates. So case number two, we take the same sort of beaker. We have our mixtures in here, A, 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 B, B, B. And now what's going to happen is the boiling point of A is going to be is less than boiling point of B. Essentially, what we're saying is that the pressure of the vapor of A is greater than the pressure of the vapor of B. And if we take it back to Raoult's law where we had here, what we're saying then is that because the vapor pressure of A is greater than the vapor pressure of B, then the mole fraction of A is going to be greater than the mole fraction of B. In essence, what happens is, because vapor pressure is proportional to the number of moles that are in the gas phase, that's what PV equals NRT tells us, then the amount of A that is sitting over this is significantly enriched relative to the amount of B. And if I could find a way to capture this gas and run it through a condenser and then capture it in a new beaker, then the new solution, I really didn't have the color I wanted it to have. The new solution is going to look like this. So can just capture what's in here. And that's my new solution. And the new solution now is enriched in A. That's the essence of distillation. That's why distillation actually works. It works because it uses the differences in the boiling points, which means the differences in the vapor pressures, to enrich the vapor in the lower boiling material, capturing that vapor, condensing it back into a liquid, and then separating it from the original material into a new receiving flask. That's how distillation actually works. And what we can do then is we can take and we can create a phase diagram that looks at what we're going to have is mole fraction down here. So this will be mole fraction. And we're going to have 100% of A, and then we'll go down to 80, 60, 40, 20, and we'll go down to zero, and 100% of B, 80% B, 60% B, 40, 20, and zero. So basically what I've got is, yeah, that'll work. So blue was B and red was A. So there's our mole fractions. On the y-axis, what we have is we have boiling point or temperature. I don't want to make it boiling point. Let's make it temp. And we can have the boiling point of B up here. So this will be our boiling point of material B. Down here, we'll have the boiling point of material A. And so that means that I have out here at 100%, I can come up here on my graph, and I have a point on my graph here, and I have a point on my graph here, and I get two lines. I get a line which is, comes down like this as a curve, and a line that comes over here as a curve. Now what these are is this is the vapor composition at the top. And on the bottom, the liquid composition. And so now what I can do is I can take any arbitrary mixture, and let's say that we start off at a point that is out here. We're going to start off at 90% B and 10% of A. That's going to give us a liquid that is at this point here. And so that's going to be my boiling point of my mixture at 90% B and 90% A. So that material is going to boil here. So this is my boiling point of my mixture. And when that mixture boils, its vapor composition is going to be given by the horizontal mark on the vapor composition line. And so when I come down into that, what I see is a new vapor composition. And that vapor composition is looking like it's sort of like 45-ish percent B. And now, what are we, 65% A? And so the amount of A that is in this system has dramatically increased from 10% on up to 65%. And the amount of B has fallen from 90% to 45%. So we have taken a mixture that was only 10% in A, and just by boiling it and capturing its vapor, we have converted it into 65%. So imagine taking this, imagine if you could have some sort of distillation where you boiled the material, took the gas that came out of that, sequestered that gas, dumped it into another beaker so that you captured it, and then you boiled it again. So we put heat under this, take that gas, capture it, condense it, throw it into another container, and then take that and boil it and make a gas, capture it, throw it into a new container. The more times that you could do this, the more you could increase the amount of A. And that's what this graph is telling us. This graph is telling us is that if I condense this, this is my new liquid concentration. If I boil it again, I'm over here. If I condense it, I'm here. If I boil it, I'm here. The more times I boil it and then condense it, I can get all the way until I can get to pure A. And I can isolate just pure A. And then when all of A is gone, then I can boil out pure B. And I can physically separate the two components 100% into their individual constituencies. That's what distillation actually does. And the way that it does it is we don't do it repeated times. We do it with a piece of glassware called a distillation apparatus, so that when we go through and we take a distillation pot and we put on a large column, so this is the distilling column, there is then a distillation head that fits onto this and a condenser. The condenser is double walled. This double walled condenser seals that piece off there and then comes up into a top up here. There's usually a thermometer that comes in and sits inside of this. So the thermometer is there. This side has the vacuum adapter and this seals off there. There's usually another piece of glassware that comes down to make this drip correctly. And then the round bottom that can attach to this and the receiving flask that fits in it. So we have water going in, water coming out. That is our cooling water that is coming out of there. This is open to the atmosphere. We have a spin vane that sits in here, our liquid, and some sort of apparatus for heat. Usually this is some type of heating mantle. And then what winds up happening is the solution that's in here that is a mixture winds up boiling. And as it boils, it hits the cool glassware. And as it hits the cool glassware, then at that point, it turns into a liquid. And we get liquid that forms on the walls of the condenser. That liquid then heats up and boils. And then it turns into a liquid again. And then it heats up and boils. And then it turns into a liquid again. Each time it's doing this, it is enriching itself in the lower boiling material. And the longer the column is, and the more surface area there is in the column, the more number of times it does this. And so essentially what happens is by using a long column and a lot of surface area, eventually what comes over is just the one material that then turns into a liquid and flows down and drips out here and gets collected as the one component mixture in the distillation. So that what we say about each one of these areas in this graph is that these areas in this graph are called theoretical plates. They are points of condensation. And revaporization. And that the more theoretical plates you have, the more you can separate, and the better separation you can achieve. And separation is proportional. So each one of these would be considered to be theoretical plates. And the theoretical plates, are proportional to height and surface area. So the more height in the column you can have and the more surface area you have, the better the separation you can achieve. So usually how much material do you lose when doing a distillation? It depends on the size of the glassware. The sides of the glassware do wind up absorbing or coating with some of your material. If, just to give you sort of an idea, if this were a flask that was a 25 milliliter flask, and you were using about 14 milliliters of solution, you could lose as much as half out of this. You would lose maybe about 7 milliliters to the glassware and not be able to recover those 7 milliliters to the glassware. On a small scale distillation, so if we go back up to distillation apparatuses and you're on a micro scale distillation apparatus like this, then you might only lose a half a mil to the glassware and still get a really nice distillation because of the way that the glassware works. So it really depends on the size of the glassware as to how much you lose, which means that when we do a large distillation, like what I was doing down here, it doesn't make sense to do that large distillation on only a 25 milliliter flask. You would reserve that for more doing like 250 milliliters or something like that, because then you would only lose 7 out of the 250, and that's not losing very much. So it really depends upon the size of the glassware to how much you lose in the distillation. So that's a good question. Remembering the rotovap, it looked like there was sort of a big distillation apparatus built in. That was a condenser, the recrystallization solvent for safe collection. Yes, that is absolutely correct, Colin, that the condenser on the rotovap looked a lot like this guy, only oriented sort of more diagonally. And its job was exactly the same, to take hot vapors, condense them back down into a liquid so that we could capture them. And that apparatus, the rotovap, is exactly that sort of design. It's a distillation apparatus, but being done under vacuum. So the vacuum port there is actually hooked to a vacuum. So in that one, if we were to take this still pot, and let's take the still pot and put it over here. So this is our still pot. And then we put it in a tank of water. So this is hot water. That's our heating bath. This thing is then hooked up to a long arm that goes through a mechanism that allows it to be able to rotate, so that this thing is a motor that allows it to rotate. And then that whole thing gets hooked to a condenser, and the condenser stems off of this and broadens way out. It's a big old fancy condenser. And in this fancy condenser, we had water in and water out, and a series of coils where this thing just coils on through here and then coils back through the center and goes out the exit. And then there was a pot that was down here that sat in a cooling bath, and we had ice water in here. And up at the top of this, there was a little valve that allowed me to allow air in and out inside that valve. So water went in, water went out. I had a second thing here that was a port that went to the vacuum. Not my best drawing, it's a little bit rough, but essentially it has all the same components. Its job was to do a vacuum distillation. And we didn't do it for removing, or we didn't do it for separating out different liquids. We use that for removing all liquid, and we did it in a very fast way by reducing the pressure, increasing the temperature, and increasing the surface area through rotation. But it wasn't designed to remove one liquid from many. It was designed to remove all solvents out of, and leave behind solids. That's the job of a rotovap. Although a rotovap, I will say, can be used to remove a solvent and leave behind an oil. And we, the difference between a liquid and an oil is that an oil is considered to be a very, very high boiling material that has a boiling point up around 200, 300, or even higher, whereas a solvent usually has a boiling point which is below 120, 130 degrees. And so we can remove those solvents very quickly, leaving behind oily constituents. And it is a distillation of type. So Colin, thumbs up to you. That was a great observation, okay? Any other questions before I go on a little bit? We've sort of like done the idea of where distillation comes from. We understand now how the distillant column works and why the distillant column is important. We understand that it's proportional to both the height of the distillant column and also the surface area. And the next sort of topic is how we change height and surface area to achieve different separations. So that's sort of the next little chunk here that I want to talk about. So I'm going to stop for a second and see if there's any questions from you guys before I keep going. Now we're doing all right. Okay, let's keep it going then. Let me look at a little bit of data. So I'm going to give you guys boiling point difference versus theoretical plates needed. So that's kind of where we're at. How many theoretical plates do I need? This is just a nice piece of data to kind of have in the back of your head whenever you're thinking about doing distillation. So what we've got is we've got two component mixture. With a difference in boiling point versus theoretical plates. So we'll say difference in boiling point versus number theoretical plates. And this is the number of theoretical plates needed to achieve separation. So we'll do the difference in the boiling point and the number of theoretical plates. And the numbers are derived from an equation that I don't have at my disposal in my brain. I'd have to look it up. But I'm just going to go through these differences and throw down the numbers because I find it kind of cool to know what I'm dealing with in terms of these boiling point differences. 10, 7, 4, 2. Okay, if you have 108 degree difference, it requires one theoretical plate to be able to separate out the two materials. If you have a boiling point difference of 72 degrees, it's two theoretical plates. At 54 degrees difference, it's 3. At 43, it's 4. At 36, it's 5. But it looks sort of like we're doing a linear relationship here. By the time you get to a 20 degree difference, it takes 10 theoretical plates. By the time you get to a 10 degree difference, it takes 20 theoretical plates. By the time you get to a 7 degree difference, it takes 30. At 4, it takes 50. At 2, it takes 100. So if you're trying to separate two materials that have a 2 degree difference, you need 100 theoretical plates in order to effectively separate those two materials. And what we said was that separation depended upon column height and surface area. So there's two different ways that we can achieve this. We can look at column height and surface area. So let me grab a couple of columns. Where was it? There we go. Let's copy this. Take this back over. Wrong spot. And let's increase this size so that we can see it a little better. Okay. So there's a couple of different types of column design. One type of column design is called a Vigorix column. These materials, this one over here, is the Vigorix column. And basically what they do is they increase the surface area by putting divots into the glass using a tool while the glass is hot. They basically poke a sharp instrument into the tool while the glass is hot. And what that does is it increases the number of theoretical plates. Now you could think about this sort of as a one-to-one ratio of each layer. This would be one theoretical plate, two, three, four, five, but it doesn't actually go linear like that. The theoretical plate is not necessarily an actual plate, but just relative to the amount of surface area that is inside the column itself. So by putting all these divots, we increase the surface area, and this has a higher number of theoretical plates than a column that has no divots in it. Eric, do bubbler trays in a distillation column count towards theoretical plates? Bubbler trays. Eric, can you unmute your mic for a second and maybe expand on what you mean by a bubbler tray?
So when I was taking an engineering course a while back, they were talking about how in a distillation column, you can install what's called a bubbling tray, which is literally just a tray in the column with holes to allow material to flow up and material to flow down.
Okay, I got it. Yes, that is a type of plate that if we take the column, those are another way of increasing surface area, but they are not used all that frequently in the columns. The problem with them is that they can, those damn trays that have holes in them, it's like a little disc that fits here. And inside the disc, there are holes in the disc. And they station these inside, and they are actually ceramic or glass, and they have the holes in them, and they work as theoretical plates, absolutely. But the damn holes get clogged. And when the holes get clogged, they stop the flow of the liquid through it, and the vapor pressure builds up underneath, and the whole thing can explode. So you need to be really careful in how you use those types of plates and columns that have those types of plates in them. And yeah, they act as theoretical plates, but they are not as safe as something like the Vigorix column, where it cannot actually clog because of the shape of it. So yeah, a little bit like a honeycomb, Finn, more like a tree of life formation. I don't know about the tree of life, but it's what happens is as vapors come up it, hot vapors come up and they hit the cooler surface and they condense into a liquid on the plate itself. And then once that heats up enough, those vaporize and go to the next stage and then they condense down into a liquid and then they re-vaporize. And they go to the next stage. And so it continues going like that, acting like the theoretical plates. The same thing is happening here. Hot gases come up on this plate, and then they condense on these surface areas, and then they heat up and re-vaporize, and they go to the next stage where they condense. And then they heat up again. And the hard part is that when you look at the column while the distillation is going, you don't see liquid. What you see is a perfectly clear, homogeneous column that looks as though it is all gas and zero liquid. And the hard part is to understand that at the molecular level, the liquid is condensing and the gas is condensing into a liquid and is revaporizing, and happening at every level throughout that column. You just can't see it taking place, but it is happening. And so you get all these theoretical plates, and this idea of vaporizing, condensing, vaporizing, condensing, vaporizing, condensing is happening throughout the column, throughout the entire distillation, not just at the beginning or end of the distillation. It happens throughout the entire process of the distillation, such that we get graphs that when we look at our time versus temp graphs, or even volume versus temp graphs, that we come up to the boiling point, and then there's generally a fairly sharp spike, and then the next boiling point. So we get the boiling point of A, the boiling point of B, and a fairly sharp rise in temperature in the transition as A ran out and only B left. And so the system cranks up to the heat of the boiling point of B, and then B starts distilling out of the material itself as well. So some other ways that we can achieve that without having special glass condensers where they have divots in them is to use things like the glass tubing, the glass spheres, little glass helices, or even a stainless steel sponge. And so all of those things that we can call them packed columns, and those packed columns put the beads inside of here. And so we get all the little beads packed up inside of it, and that makes our packed column. And then that packed column has more increased in surface area and has more theoretical plates in it, so that we can actually achieve a better separation with the packed column than we can with an unpacked column. So we can change the column height. We can also change the nature of the column itself to give the column more surface area. And those are two ways to increase separation. And basically what we have is two different types. Let me go back and grab another image. I think it was this image over here with all of these types of distillations. Let me grab this one again. And we have different names for the different types of distillations. So bringing this image back online, what we have is a simple distillation. Both of these would be considered to be simple distillations. And they're simple because of the short column height. Also here, short column height. And that compares to a fractional distillation. Let me go grab a different image where this is a fractional distillation. Oh, come on. So this one is what's called fractional. And the fractional one is a long packed column. Or dimpled. We can go with, what was the name? Vigruex. And on the small scale, so when we look at the micro scale and we have this little column, they make micro scale ones that are fractional as well. And the micro scale ones that are fractional are really cool. They're really pretty. So, and we have a couple of them at Cabrillo. Those look a little bit like this. We have a column that comes down that is a Vigorex column, and it goes into a ground glass joint and then allows for sort of the teardrop-shaped flask or even a round flask. And then off of this column that has all the little dimples in it, it it has an integrated water jacketed condenser where the glassware is all one piece. It has the, oh, that's not that size. We'll get it in a second. It has the port up. And then down on the glassware down here, it's got the port out. And then this piece turns and comes to the vacuum condenser and has a ground glass joint on it down below that. And this is a double wall jacketed condenser. And cordons off there and there. And then there's a tube that extends out of this and comes down fairly long and takes a turn. And there is a piece that goes onto this that is what is called an udder flask. So the udder flask comes out like this and then has projections for different round bottoms to be able to collect the different fractions. And this guy takes a turn and dumps out into different ones. And you can rotate this flask while the distillation is going. And there's a piece of glass that connects these two just to stabilize the whole thing, and a ground glass thermometer that fits into this, sitting at just the right height. And water goes in here and out here. And this is a microscale fractional column. And that microscale fractional column, they run about, $600, $700. They're all hand blown and they're all one piece of glass all fused together. So the only things that come off are you've got your still pot, you've got the column itself, and then you've got the receiving flask, and this we call an udder flask. Udder flask as in like a cow udder, because cow udders have multiple nipples on them, and the cow udder flask has up to four different round bottoms that can fit onto it, and you can rotate that and take fractions while the distillation is going so that you don't have to actually swap out round bottoms. You just rotate this thing and swap to the different round bottom. And Finn, you had a question, to distill different solutes at lower temperatures. And Colin, did I miss the function purpose of the fractional distillation column? The purpose is that up in here, this guy's, when you start getting this many fractional theoretical plates, these require a fractional column. Whereas if your boiling points are close enough, far enough away, big enough, such that the difference between the two boiling points is big enough, these can be done with a simple column. They don't need the fractional column. So whether you choose, which apparatus you choose, whether you choose simple or fractional, is dependent upon how different your boiling points are within your mixture. And Finn, to distill different solids at lower temperatures, it's not the lower temperatures per se, but same thing that I was saying to Colin, in that it's about mixtures that have a bigger difference in their boiling points. We can use the simple distillational ones to do that. Matt, how do you know when to rotate the udder flask? Oh, that's a great question, Matt. I love that question. Okay, so no, you don't go by time. You go by watching the temperature. So what happens is, here's a typical distillation. That is a great question. When you look at a graph, let's do a large graph here, which is volume of distillate. I gotta spell distillate first. Distillate, A-T-E, I don't know, okay. And temp. What happens in a typical distillation as you're doing it in a two-component mixture, so this is two components, the temperature generally rises and steadies. And then at some point, the temperature crashes. And then the temperature rises quickly and goes to the next component. And so this would be theoretically the boiling point of A. And this up here, right where I put wrote temperature, this is the boiling point of B, of the next constituent that's coming out. And so this is my temp that's coming up. And the question is, what happens here? Why the crash? Okay, to explain that, what we need to do is we need to look at where the thermometer sits inside the distillation apparatus. So the proper placement of a thermometer is at the location, if we envision the condenser and where the condenser sits here, such that this is my condenser. And I thought I heard another question there. People are popping in and out, I'm not sure. Okay, what happens here is that the thermometer needs to come in, and the bulb of the thermometer needs to sit at the height where the phase transition is occurring. So this is my phase transition condensation of vapor. So let's say that what's happening is the distillation is ongoing. I have the still pot, which is all the way down here. We'll just take and we'll put that still pot down here. And so we've got a couple of lines. The column is really big and the still pot is down here. And what's going on is that this two component mixture, which has A and B in it, it is boiling. And as it boils, the vapor is coming up and A is the only thing that is making it up here. And A is turning into a liquid. And so I'm getting liquid A that is flowing down the condenser and going into the receiving flask. At some point, A runs out. At some point, you have distilled all of A out of this mixture that can happen. And so what happens at that point is the liquid stops forming and the vapor goes away. As the vapor goes away, what was it that was heating the thermometer? What was heating the thermometer was condensation that was happening on the thermometer and the hot vapors and the dripping back down of liquid that was falling back down into the pot. But when A ran out, that all went away. When that went away, the temperature crashed. The temperature right here, oops, that is not what I meant to do. Put that back. The temperature right here crashed when A ran out. And there's no more vapor hitting thermometer. And then what happens is the temperature now, A is now gone. Now the temperature cranks up because now there's only B in there. So the temperature can get hotter. So now B starts to come through. And as B starts to come through, the thermometer once again gets bathed in vapor and the temperature accordingly goes up. So what we have is we have A and we have B. And when I change over the flask is dictated by when I see that crash. That's what I look for, is I look for the crash in temperature before the temperature spikes. And when I see that crash, that's when I flip the flask. That's when I capture B coming through all by itself. So I look for that crash in temperature, and that means that you have to monitor it. You can't walk away from it because you never know when to really flip the flask. So you have to watch it and watch your temperatures. You got a steady temperature. Temperature all of a sudden crashes. We know that something new is going to come through. So what we do is we generally flip the flask before that new thing starts coming through. We get a little bit of mixture of A and B come through, and then we wait until the temperature rises and stabilizes. When it stabilizes, we flip it a third time, or second time, really. That second time is when we're collecting all of B. So literally what happens is we get A coming out here. We get A plus B. This is at the crash. And then once it stabilizes again, then I flip it again, and then I get all B. That's the way that I sort of manage that. So that's how I know when to take fractions. That was a great question. All right. Let's see. There's a couple of things that I was going to do in terms of practical points. I think I'm going to save those for next time. I've been talking for a while now, and we went on a couple of little deviations and some great questions. And I think I'll talk about how not to create bombs, never to distill to dryness, clamping. We talked about position of the bulb, but we'll talk about how not to make bombs and not distilling to dryness and why to do those things. We'll catch those things next time. I think the next class will also do azeotropes. We'll talk about azeotropes, which is non-ideal solutions. Those are really cool and very useful for certain circumstances. We'll also go into gas chromatography and talk about gas chromatography next time as well. So one more day on distillation for these guys. And let me pause it there and ask if there's any other questions before we call it a day on this one.
I had a quick question about the udder flask.
Yeah.
Would you still see that like temperature spike even if you're doing one where the melting or the boiling point is different, like with the smaller difference?
Ooh. Yes, when you have a smaller difference, the crash is not as prominent. And so what happens is, this is sort of an idealized graph that I have drawn that that has two components with a fractional distillation. So two components, fractional distillation. With good separation of boiling points. If you have boiling points that are closer, the graph is never as pretty. And you still oftentimes see the dip, but it's not as prominent. So you'll see that you'll get kind of a muddied outness. You'll get B. But the dip is never as strong when the boiling points are close, or the column not as good, not as fractionating. So when we mean good, it's not as fractionating. I guess, I don't know if that's a real word or not, but it just means that the column is not separating out the materials as well as it could be. That when you have a true fractionating column with a good number of theoretical plates for the difference in boiling point that you're experiencing, you'll see a good dip. If you're using a short distillation, a simple distillation, and not as good a fractionating column, then the dips are never as prominent, and you got to look closer to see them. You got to do a little more guesswork to where you think those dips actually are. Yeah, good question too. Anything else? All right, so you can kind of think about those questions too. You can bring those questions into the next lab. And if you want to read ahead a little bit, or even get a little bit more reading into the sections that I've covered, I am covering the appendix sections on distillation in the back of Pavia. And I think it's in the newer book, I think it's appendix 12, 13, and 14 that are the distillation sections. And they cover both the boiling point differences, the simple versus fractional, and then they get into some other. No, Nicole, I didn't send out the questions for the last report. I got to send those out yet. I'm going to sit down and try and do those and pull some. I got distracted with Canvas, and I was trying to get the Canvas shell up and running and forgot about that until this morning and realized that I forgot to mail it out. So I need to jump back up on that, and I'll send it out with a due date and give you guys enough time to do it. So I won't keep the same due date or crash it on you. I'll give you adequate time to work on it. Okay? No, you didn't miss anything. We're all good. Any other questions? All right. If you guys are all good, let's close it out there. And I'll see you on Wednesday. All right? Take care. Stay healthy. And we'll see you guys later. All right? Thanks a lot.